I'm Scott Walston, president of TPI. I'll be moderating this fireside chat, which is part of TPI's Winter Spectrum series. Our guest, Dale Hatfield, needs no introduction, but I'm going to give one anyway. Dale has a storied career over his more than 70 years of experience in telecom policy and regulation, spectrum management, and related areas. He's currently executive fellow at the Silicon Flatiron Center for Law, Technology, and Entrepreneurship, and an adjunct professor in the Interdisciplinary Telecommunications Program, both at the University of Colorado at Boulder. But before that, he did almost everything else you can possibly imagine in this field. He was the chief of the Office of Engineering and Technology and chief technologist at the FCC. Before that, he founded and ran Hatfield Associates, a multidisciplinary telecommunications consulting firm. And before that, he was acting assistant secretary of commerce for communications and information and acting administrator of NTIA. And before that, he was chief of the Office of Plans and Policy at the FCC. He was also the founding executive director of the Broadband Internet Technical Advisory Group. He's currently serving on the FCC's Technology Advisory Council and on the Commerce Department's Spectrum Management Advisory Committee. So to summarize all that quickly, in case you weren't paying attention, he's been at OET and OPP at the FCC, AAS and CCIA at NTIA and DOC, as well as the ED at BITAG, FCC, TAC, and CSMAC. So I think he's got all the acronyms that you could possibly have. Really means is that for more than half a century, Dale has been the reliable, thoughtful connection between policy and engineering, helping generations of people understand what spectrum is, how wireless technologies work, and how policies interact with those. Dale, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Scott, for the very kind, generous introduction. And thank you also for asking me to address the topic of growing threats to wireless communications and how to address them. If you would permit me, being at my age, I always like to tell a story. So if you would allow me, I'll tell a story here quickly of how long I've been involved. I was a ham radio operator 70 years ago. And some of you may know the amateur 6 meter band is directly adjacent to television channel 2. And so when I got my license and went on the air, immediately almost, our neighbor called and said to my parents, "Your son is disrupting our TV." Now, this is back in the over-the-air days. And the problem was, is that I had a high power transmitter and some of my energy was spilling over into channel 2. And I'll try to use kind words here. The receiver manufacturers had really skimped on the performance of the receivers. So they were receiving a lot of my energy outside the band that they were trying to receive, which was channel 2. The kind of funny part of it is, there were solutions. You could buy a filter that went on a TV set that filtered out the signals that I was transmitting. And that was a fairly cheap, small device. But since I was operating high power, I had to have a great big filter that prevented me from swapping over into there. And when I sit and listen to the discussions today, boy, we still got some of the things where we want to pack more people into the spectrum, but you got these sort of adjacent band or adjacent channel issues. So thank you for allowing me to divert to.
Could I ask a follow-up question on that?
Oh,
in that example, did you end up with a Kosian solution where the two of you were able to come to some agreement, or was there an external government like your parents who made you do something?
Yeah, they said get it fixed in no uncertain terms. So I bore the, they may have helped, I don't remember, but I think I used some of my grass mowing money or something to buy the parts necessary for them and for my transmitter.
Well, early policy interventions. Okay, so let's move to what our actual topic is. Tell us, you know, wireless wise, what keeps you up at night?
Well, in preparing I picked a total of 8 threats and some potential solutions, and we can talk about them more or less as you may see fit and time allows. But my first concern is the jamming, spoofing, stiffing, and unauthorized interception of radio frequency or RF signals. That's what really keeps me up at night. I could give you some recent examples, but people do not appreciate as much as they should, that wireless is inherently open. And we can explore that a little bit if there's time and energy. The second area that I'm particularly concerned about is RF pollution, where the spectrum is becoming polluted from a whole host of different sources. I'm concerned about one particular type, which is the use of what's called switch mode power supplies. But if you look at it, in my mind, the fundamental role of the FCC, of course, is to protect. They're kind of an original environmental protection agency. They need to protect against pollution. And then there's enforcement. This is my third point. Enforcement challenges associated with detecting, classifying, identifying, locating, reporting, mitigating, remediating, and reporting interference and the sort of jamming and spoofing examples that I gave a moment ago. I can go through those a little bit more. But just to pick the first one, before you can do anything about interference, you have to detect it. And it may be, the signal may be of such a design, it's very difficult to detect, yet call it causing problems.
Before you talk in more detail about the ways to address the threats, could you define a little bit about what the different threats are? Because they're different. Jamming, spoofing, RF pollution are, you know, they're not all the same thing, and they don't require, I mean, they don't necessarily have the same solutions. And for a lot of us, we just don't know what the difference is between those things.
Basically, jamming is putting a signal out, nefariously, a signal out that prevents somebody else from receiving their intended. The example of jamming would be a school teacher who says, I don't want my kids using their phones in class, therefore I'll go, and you can do a quick Google search and you can find jammers. And then he or she would jam the signals. Well, the problem is, of course, that prevents the parents then from calling and checking on their children. The person in the next classroom might be jammed as well. So that would be an example of a jamming. And we can go through the list. It can be done for very, very bad reasons, or it can be young people at university saying, hey, wouldn't it be fun to jam the parking lot control signals so that you can't open the gates after a football game? And I'll do it for bragging rights. So that's the jamming. Spoofing, of course, is pretending you're something else. This happens in GPS. I'll send a signal that looks like a legitimate GPS signal, but it's really not. It's a GPS signal generated by somebody who wants to destroy your ability to find your position, to get precise timing, or for navigation. So the GPS, GNSS, as we more broadly, that's an excellent example for spoofing is a problem. Another one that is when you're using your cell phone, you assume you're talking to the carrier's tower. You may not be. And this is what they call the man in the middle attack. Somebody is in there between you and the legitimate tower and can then extract certain information if they want to. Finally, sniffing or unauthorized reception comes about. For example, I can learn a lot by just seeing how you operate your system. So I just observe you. And when you react to some sort of interference, what do? So I can learn about your network by just listening to what's going on. And there's other examples too of where you use a sniffing in an attempt to learn a similar sort of thing. So one of the things, of course, it helps you learn how to do a better job of launching jamming attacks and spoofing attacks, because you've learned a lot about the network by passively listening. And I think I hope I made that point clear.
Yeah. So let me ask. Those are all on the malicious side of potential problems. In the previous panel, we had people who, you know, discussing all different, you know, disagree on lots of aspects of spectrum, whether it's, you know, wireless, unlicensed, exclusive licensed, how to decide how much federal agency should have as opposed to the private sector. But I would think they all agree on the potential problems and harms of the things that you're talking about. And you think that they would put a lot of effort into dealing with them. Are you concerned that the efforts have not been sufficient?
Quickly going back to the seven steps in enforcement that I talked on. One, you've got remediation there. Remediation, you want to stop what's going on. You want to stop it right away. So you need to have action. And then if you're going to remediate, you want to put somebody in jail ultimately, or these can be bad people. So you need to put them in jail, which means you have trails of evidence issues and so forth to make sure that you can successfully prosecute somebody, or if it's a more militarized condition, that you can know more about what the enemy is trying to do. Was I clear on that, Tess?
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'm wondering though, if when you've talked to people who run these networks and, you know, read about examples of where these things happen, if you think that they or the government are not currently doing enough, because you think they would worry, it must keep them up at night too.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know, but I don't think Verizon has the authority to tell somebody to turn off their transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
I think that ultimately falls upon the FCC's responsibility. Now, here again, I'm not a national security. There may be other things going on here. There are certain volunteer groups like ham radio operators and stuff that do a little bit of this sort of stuff. But that's the thing. It has to be somebody with the power of government to shut things down. I mean, just think of it here in my house. The other day, my network here went down, and trying to figure out, is that something serious? Who did it? Where is it? Locate all that sort of thing is a very difficult, time-consuming battle. And it's not clear to me who has ultimate responsibility, especially when it's nefarious. In other words, it's intended. You know, it's like the example of the kid. Hey, I'll take out Hatfield's Wi-Fi just for the fun of it. So. There has to be ultimately, I think, a strong government. And to be provocative, the FCC's enforcement equipment, their enforcement network, the sites that they have to be able to track down some of this stuff is very limited. If you have something that happens to air-to-ground communications at DIA, Denver Airport, you know, they're close by. But if you're up in Wyoming someplace, it takes forever to get up there and try to get it stopped. And meanwhile, there could be bad things happening. So in my opinion, the whole enforcement structure needs to be, the whole government enforcement structure needs to be needs to be improved significantly. And, you know, of course, hopefully with the cooperation so forth of the other players, the commercial providers and DOD, et cetera, you were talking about before.
Right. That's interesting. So enforcement, this kind of enforcement, you think has not kept up with the extent to which wireless has become prevalent?
They chase pirates up here in the mountain, of course, radio stations. Mm-hmm. So they spend a lot of time chasing pirate radio, which is, you know, I'm not saying that's not important. It is important, but it's not the sort of thing that we're talking about here.
Right. I may or may not have a cousin who ran a pirate radio station.
But think about it. Just above me here, we have Boulder Canyon and a big dam, Barker Reservoir, and big dam up here. And that's being controlled, of course, by radio signals. Now, with what I said, you know, it can be jammed or spoofed or all of those sort of things as well. And that gets into protection of the national infrastructure, the water system, and all the other things. Is that being protected adequately? Does the government have the ability to make sure that they can get it stopped, that they can get it mitigated?
Let me ask an engineering question, I guess. And I don't know if there is an answer, if you have it. But, you know, we read about these sort of malicious attacks in war zones, in Ukraine and so on, yeah, where drones are misdirected.
Yes.
And obviously the FCC can't, that's not the kind of thing you can enforce with a law. How do you protect against that sort of thing? How is it possible?
Well, when you talk about the drone situation, if I have one single message is that wireless systems are inherently open. So you can't get, ultimately, you cannot really protect against it. I've lost your question, Mark. Scott, I'm sorry.
That's fine. I mean, I think that's an answer. I was asking how you would deal with that in a war zone where there's not necessarily rule of law and enforcement, but you have to figure out a technical way. And I think your answer is that it's impossible to completely guard against it.
Yeah. There is an example of in California, there was a guy who deliberately was jamming all the police radio systems and cellular systems from a location. And you can win a little bit, even though the local police probably don't have jurisdiction to stop the person. You know, showing up at somebody's door with a gun on your hip does have a certain deterrent effect. And that leads to a more serious, should some of this, since the interference occurs sometimes at very local levels, should we try to give some sort of enforcement power locally so you've got help closer to the source of the malicious interference, for example.
Now, there's, of course, a whole other type of threat, which we've sort of called innocent, might be the wrong word, but not malicious. Talk about those a little bit. And also, I should add, in the Q&A, which people should remember is there, you can ask questions. Preston Padden, because this is a good place to put the question. Well, first, he has a rhetorical question, which is, how did so much knowledge and wisdom end up in one person? That would be you. And then the second question is related to this, which is going to you're going to talk about interference, which you mentioned before. What should we do about receiver standards? So,
well, Preston, thank you for the softball question. Of course, you know, you can have millions of transmitters and they don't interfere with each other when they're out in the ether, so to speak. The problem comes when you put the first receiver out. It has to sort out from all those transmitted signal to get the desired signal that they want. That's where the problem occurs. And it's just so clear that if we're going to do for spectrum, if we're really going to go to more dynamic spectrum ways where we are much more dynamic in spectrum, yeah, just have to do something about the receivers. There's just no question. I have heard very informally recently that the chairwoman is going to maybe step up a little bit at looking at the receivers. And I think that's a very, very wise step. But I've been saying that for...
Well, at least since you were a ham radio operator and your neighbors didn't have a...
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right.
So I interrupted, unfortunately, but, you know, talking about the innocent threats.
Yeah. The innocent threats, of course, are things like mistuned transmitters, mistuned receivers. That's example. Why do people do this sort of stuff? Well, financial gain. I said prank. I used the example of teachers or theater owners. Theater owners are too. They put in jammers so people's cell phones don't go off in the middle of an event. So those are the sort of non-malicious. Here again, there's no bad person. They're not doing it to prevent you from checking, you know, where your child is or something like that cell phone. But the result, I suppose you can say the economic term, there's an externality here and putting in the,
I assume it's always illegal though, right? Unless you're
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's very, very clear. I think statutorily, jammers. But there's been some prisons, because prisoners were using cell phones to coordinate drug craving activities outside. So there was a proceeding regarding the use of jammers by law enforcement people for the limited purposes of, but here again, how the law gets waived in that case and so forth. I hasten to add that I'm not a lawyer. If you, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, continue. Especially, you talked about switched mode power supplies. And again, that's something that, you need to explain that a little bit.
Yes. By the way, if you're sitting near a computer, you can just type into Google, advantages and disadvantages, switch mode versus linear power supplies, and it'll give you the answer. But the thing to keep in mind, the basic sort of kernel here, is when you change the direction of radio waves are generated by moving electrons, by electricity moving very fast back and forth. And what we're talking about here is the switch mode power supplies. The switch mode power supplies essentially chop up the signal that you're trying to send and convert it into a very, very broadband signal. And you would say, why in the heck would you do that? Well, it turns out that they're much more efficient. They have much better control circuitry, so you don't overcharge your whatever device it is. And to bring this home, to be personal about it, my wife is disabled and uses a scooter, electric scooter. And the latest one we bought, what did it say? We're using this modern switch mode power supply. So what they're doing, they're chopping up this voltage from the batteries, and they got much more powerful, so it doesn't overcharge at night, so it make sure it's charged in the morning, does all that. But the price of it is, the trade-off that I don't think is being recognized, is that pollutes, that causes serious pollution of the, in my mind, at least the potential for. Even worse is the EV charging stations. Now you're not just turning on and off a little bit of electricity, like my wife's wheelchair. You're turning on and off at very high speed, if you will, very, very high. If you're trying to charge a truck, for example, these are huge things that are generate interference. And I don't think we've seen the worst of it. For example, the studies in California that I've seen so far, where people pull up to a charging station and it says not in service. Well, my feeling is, in some of those locations anyway, what it is, they are essentially blasting out huge amounts of this very rapidly changing voltage. So it's producing interference. a colleague of mine wrote a paper essentially saying VHF is dead. VHF is dead. And you say, well, who cares about VHF? Well, you look at it, there's all kinds of very important military, state police. There's all kinds of people in this VHF range that can be affected. And as we add, keep adding, you know, you have an EV station that has 10 places to park today. Tomorrow it may have 30 or so. And then you get into the issue of accumulated interference. People tell me, well, there's rules against incidental radiation. And I say that's true, but that doesn't mean that they're adequate when you have, you know, thousands of them or hundreds of them contributing to it. So there's that issue as well.
So if I understand it, it's the constant on and off of the power that creates RF interference. And the higher the power levels, the greater the interference.
That's right.
And so is this something that, you know, you can, if you take your phone or you're trying to use a Wi-Fi signal near, let's say, a Tesla supercharger, it's noticeable? You can see interference?
The evidence is largely anecdotal. And that goes to a point of the FCC, in my opinion, should be out taking a look at this, because some of these systems coordinate the chargers using Wi-Fi, for example. That's an unlicensed, or not entitled to any protection. So is it bothered? And if it's a semi-public station, you don't want to re-enter your information every time you pull up to it. So you got to communicate. Well, Wi-Fi, as we know, was never intended for that sort of serious use. So right now, once things are out of service, it may be because of the thing. More to the point, crying out here for the FCC to have more capabilities, working with DOT or whoever it is, to see what the facts of the situation are before it becomes so bad that it becomes almost impossible to handle.
Right. So your point isn't that we know that this is necessarily a big problem, but it could be, and they're ignoring the possibility and it needs study?
I would go beyond that. I would put my engineering reputation on the line in saying that some of the problems we're having at the charging stations are due to interference to the Bluetooth or whatever. Now, some, of course, to connect to their ISP, I don't know. Maybe Tesla uses a fiber optic cable to connect to their ISP, in which case they don't have the problem.
Right.
Somebody else can't afford to put in fiber everywhere, instead uses radio. They're gonna be subject to the sort of contamination I'm talking about.
And I'm sorry if this is a silly question, but you know, often the problem, as Ed implied, is with the receivers. In this case, the power is acting as a transmitter. Is that so? So in this case, though, it's the transmitter that needs some kind of filters, or I don't know. How do you like? What's the answer?
Well, do you remember? I think probably in some of the movies, the radio operator was called Sparks.
Yeah. Huh?
Why was he called Sparks? Because he generated rapid changes in electricity. The very first transmitters were spark gap transmitters that generated sparks, and that's what we're doing here. Can you filter some of it? You can improve, but this is here again. It's a wireless. Remember, this is a wireless system. You can't make it entirely. You can't get all the result. From an economics term, we may know what the solution is, but can you afford to do it? And we haven't talked about IoT devices and very small devices that don't have, you know, intelligent capabilities to try to avoid interference. So this is a tough problem.
Well, also, I just on MASH, Klinger and Radar were always calling Sparky. to set up the telephone connection back home. I never knew why until now. So what are possible solutions to this? It sounds almost intractable.
I try not in my old age to get depressed. But there is one thing I haven't mentioned on the enforcement side that could be helpful. Now, this is not a panacea. It's actually rather narrow. And that's called RF fingerprinting. It turns out that every transmitter built by whoever has a unique signature. In other words, I can identify the transmitter by the fact that no two transmitters are exactly the same, just as no two people's fingerprints are the same. This is based upon manufacturing variations. So if I have, for example, a whole bunch of drones coming in, may want to attack or cause all kinds of problems, I can in advance put in the devices that I know should be there. And if there is one whose fingerprint doesn't match, then that's one we better go after. And we talk then about going back to jamming or something, about some way of taking out that particular device. And there's a lot of other uses for that. Here again, going back to the remediation phase of enforcement, I want to put the person in jail. Now I don't know whether, before I didn't know, I couldn't prove in court necessarily that it was you actually doing it with your transmitter. Now I could. I say, this is Scott Walston's cell phone that did this.
Oh, keep me out of it.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a powerful tool, but it's rather narrow. And there's quite a bit of research, in fairness. There's an awful lot of research going on in this area because the identification of the actual device is important. Now, of course, my students would immediately put their hand, Professor Hatfield, that has all kinds of privacy implications, doesn't it? Yeah. And indeed it does.
Interesting, another trade-off.
Yes, another trade-off, exactly. Hmm. Exactly.
I was going to say that this is a good place to talk about, you know, where you see reasons for optimism, because you sounded like you started down that track until you pointed out the downsides of the privacy implications. But, you know, what, you know, do you see reasons for progress or optimism in these issues? I mean, you mentioned one, and so that's, I mean, the research is good.
Yeah. What shock you saying, the answer is money. What's the question?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not sure. There are things that are periphery. One thing is, I don't think we do enough risk assessment. Hmm. Scott, you may know much more about risk assessment than I do. We have risk-informed interference analysis, where we can't solve all of these problems, but what you do is try to go after the problems, like opening the floodgates up here on the dam and letting the water, and you go for the really big hits. And if it's just the kid interrupting my Wi-Fi, you kind of let it go. And by coming up with a list of the types of attacks and their impact, then you can do a much better job of taking society's scarce resources and devoting them to where they can do prevent the most damage, build in the most resilience.
And so where would you like to see, what would you hope to see in the next 5 to 10 years in these issues?
Well, one of the things is more information to help researchers like me, being self-serving. I would like to have, we don't do, and I realize there's reasons, you know, you don't want people to, as the last panel says, some people to know certain things and so forth, but we don't report well enough incidents like the incident in Calumet in California with the Walnut Creek where the guy was deliberately. We don't have, in my opinion, a good. Now, on GPS and GNSS, you can find lots of reports on that. But in general, it's very difficult to get the research information to be able to do the sort of risk-informed interference analysis and so forth that I'm talking about. So I think reporting is just so critical. So am I ducking your question? I don't mean to be ducking it.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's hard to study something without having any data for it.
Yeah.
So that does seem like a good place to start by getting it.
Yes.
So, well, I think that would be probably a good place to wrap it up. Dale, thank you so much for joining me today. It's always really a pleasure talking with you. I learn lots of new things every time. Always look forward to it.
I don't know what your protocol is, but I would invite questions or challenges to things that I've said. So what's the process for doing that? But I would love to have people say, Hatfield, you're all wet, you know.
Well, people can type that into the Q&A if they want to right now. We had some questions that we answered. People should feel free. But if not, you know, I guess I assume you're open to emails.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Is there people?
Dale.Hatfield@colorado.edu.
Oh, Preston raised his hand again. I'm not sure how to call on people. Maybe you could type his question in. Wait, no, I can allow him to talk. Hold on. Let me see. Okay. Preston, I think you're on.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can.
Yeah. My question to the great Professor Hatfield is often we use our demand for wireless data is going up like a hockey stick. And I sometimes worry about what we do when there just is no more spectrum to allocate for that demand. But in particular, we often use our scarce wireless spectrum for the carriers to send millions of duplicating streams of the same content or same data to millions of people simultaneously. And are there more efficient ways that we can, for example, I'm out to take the most extreme example, the Super Bowl. I mean, probably more than 100 million identical streams eating up spectrum with the same content at the same time. It just doesn't seem very efficient. And I'll stop there. Thank you, Scott and Dale.
Thanks, Preston. Dale, do you want to reply?
This is an art. This is an area that's, here again, been around forever. If you're, for example, police may want, you can send a message to everybody, all the police on the beat, or you can send it to just one. And there's always trade-offs. There's trade-offs here, depending upon the traffic. Some traffic you do want to, as Preston was saying, some you do want to send simultaneously the same information. Others you want to be selective about it. So I guess my only point is this is not a new issue, and it's the sort of thinking we have to be doing to cut down to be able to do more of the dynamic spectrum sharing that we've talked about.
So we have another question from Tim Brennan, who has been chief economist at the FCC. He says, "Hi Dale, with the current administration's considerable effort to encourage EV adoption and build more charging stations, how aggressive do you think the current FCC will investigate the problems with EV charging that you described?"
I think first of all, they just don't have the resources, the technical resources. Mm. The equipment needed to make and these people are very highly paid people. So it's also, there's probably issues on the hiring side. There is some encouragement. I think DOT is is looking at some of this, but I go back to the inherent sort of thing. Jurisdiction seems to me to lie with the FCC. So DOT, I think, should be cooperating, that they should be making some of these studies at these very high power charging stations, but that the commission ought to have the, or somebody, it may be, maybe we need, oh my gosh, a new agency or something to try to.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that sounds, didn't really mean that. I take that back to look at it. But I think genuine, it's my professional opinion that this is one of the externalities of our conversion from renewables. Yeah.
So let me put you in the impossible position that Chairwoman Rosenworcel would be in if she wanted to do this. Congress isn't allocating any additional money to the FCC because, well, they can't do much of anything, even if they wanted to. But what would you have the FCC do less of in order to do this? And I know that's an impossible question. It's impossible in reality and hypothetically, but still, what do you think?
That gets a little bit too deep into sort of the real politics, and I'm willing to go here of what you give up. My choice is not necessarily politically popular and so forth, so I don't really go there. Well,
that's but, probably why they're right.
But there is one, now this is a little bit self-serving. You have the Technological Advisory Council, which is supposed to be giving the commission advice on very difficult technical problems. So one of the things that I would recommend that as she do or other commissioners support is to seek the advice of people that serve on the TAC. And, you know, excluding myself, there's some really smart people on the TAC that I think could be a great, great help. So that's one kind of free, it's already in existence, but that's a little bit, like say, self-serving.
It seems like a good place to start, though. Okay, I think without any additional questions, then we'll wrap it up. Dale, again, thanks so much. Really, really a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I do invite people to reach out to me if there's things they'd like to challenge in what I've said.
I would. I don't want to inundate you with email, but I would encourage that. Because I always learn things with our exchanges, email or otherwise. So, all right. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye.